Being inexperienced, I handled the money badly, and sometimes I was a day without food. When this happened, I used to sell a few of my clothes, smuggling them out of the hotel in small packets and taking them to a second-hand shop in the Rue de la Montagne Saint-Geneviève. The shopman was a red-haired Jew, an extraordinary, disagreeable man who used to fall into furious rages at the sight of a client. From his manner, one would have supposed that we had done him some injury by coming to him. "Merde," he used to shout. "You here again? What do you think this is, a soup kitchen?" And he paid incredibly low prices. For a hat, which I had bought for 25 shillings and scarcely worn, he gave 5 francs. For a good pair of shoes, 5 francs. For shirts, 1 franc each. He always preferred to exchange rather than buy, and he had a trick of thrusting some useless article into one's hand and then pretending that one had accepted it. Once I saw him take a good overcoat from an old woman, put 2 white billiard balls into her hand, and then push her rapidly out of the shop before she could protest. It would have been a pleasure to flatten the Jew's nose if anyone could have afforded it. These 3 weeks were squalid and uncomfortable, and evidently there was worse coming, for my rent would be due before long. Nevertheless, things were not a quarter as bad as I had expected. For when you are approaching poverty, you make one discovery which outweighs some of the others. You discover boredom and mean complications and the beginnings of hunger, but you also discover the great redeeming feature of poverty, the fact that it annihilates the future. Within certain limits, it is actually true that the less money you have, the less you worry. When you have 100 francs in the world, you're liable to the most craven panics. When you have only 3 francs, you are quite indifferent, for 3 francs will feed you till tomorrow, and you cannot think further than that. You are bored, but you are not afraid. You think vaguely, I shall be starving in a day or two. Shocking, isn't it? And then the mind wanders to other topics. A bread and margarine diet does, to some extent, provide its own anodyne. And there is another feeling that is a great consolation in poverty. I believe everyone who has been hard up has experienced it. It's a feeling of relief, almost of pleasure, at knowing yourself at last genuinely down and out. You've talked so often of going to the dogs, and, well, here are the dogs, and you have reached them, and you can stand it. It takes off a lot of anxiety. Chapter 4. One day my English lessons ceased abruptly. The weather was getting hot, and one of my pupils, feeling too lazy to go on with his lessons, dismissed me. The other disappeared from his lodgings without notice, owing me 12 francs. I was left with only 30 centimes and no tobacco. For a day and a half I had nothing to eat or smoke, and then, too hungry to put it off any longer, I packed my remaining clothes into my suitcase and took them to the pawn shop. This put an end to all pretense of being in funds, for I could not take my clothes out of the hotel without asking Madame F.'s leave. I remember, however, how surprised she was at my asking her. Instead of removing the clothes on the sly, shooting the moon being a common trick in our quarter, it was the first time that I'd been in a French pawn shop. One went through grandiose stone portals, marked, of course, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité. They write that even over the police stations in France, into a large, bare room, like a school classroom, with a counter and rows of benches. 40 or 50 people were waiting. One handed one's pledge over the counter and sat down. Presently, when the clerk had assessed its value, he would call out, "Numéro such and such, will you take 50 francs? Sometimes it was only 15 francs, or 10, or 5. Whatever it was, the whole room knew it. As I came in, the clerk called with an air of offence, "Numéro 83, here," and gave a little whistle and a beckon, as though calling a dog. Numéro 83 stepped to the counter. He was an old bearded man with an overcoat buttoned up at the neck and frayed trouser ends. Without a word, the clerk shot the bundle across the counter. Evidently it was worth nothing. It fell to the ground and came open, displaying 4 pairs of men's woollen pants. No one could help laughing. Poor numéro 83 gathered up his pants and shambled out, muttering to himself. The clothes I was pawning, together with the suitcase, had cost over £20 and were in good condition. I thought they must be worth £10, and a quarter of this, one expects quarter value at a pawn shop, was 250 or 300 francs. I waited without anxiety, expecting 200 francs at the worst. At last, the clerk called my number, numéro 97. Yes, I said, standing up. 70 francs? 70 francs for £10 worth of clothes? But it was no use arguing. I had seen someone else attempt to argue, and the clerk had instantly refused the pledge. I took the money and the pawn ticket and walked out. I had now no clothes except what I stood up in, the coat badly out at the elbow, an overcoat, moderately pawnable, and one spare shirt. Afterwards, when it was too late, I learned that it was wiser to go to a pawn shop in the afternoon. The clerks are French, and like most French people, are in a bad temper till they have eaten their lunch. When I got home, Madame F. was sweeping the bistro floor. She came up the stairs to meet me. I could see in her eye that she was uneasy about my rent. "Well," she said, "what did you get for your clothes? Not much, eh?" 200 francs, I said promptly. "Tiens," she said, surprised. "Well, that's not bad. How expensive those English clothes must be." The lie saved a lot of trouble, and strangely enough, it came true. A few days later, I did receive exactly 200 francs due to me for a newspaper article, and though it hurt to do it, I at once paid every penny of it in rent. So, though I came near to starving in the following weeks, I was hardly ever without a roof. It was now absolutely necessary to find work, and I remembered a friend of mine, a Russian waiter named Boris, who might be able to help me. I first met him in the public ward of a hospital where he was being treated for arthritis in the left leg. He had told me to come to him if I were ever in difficulties. I must say something about Boris, for he was a curious character and my close friend for a long time. He was a big, soldierly man of about 35, and had been good-looking, but since his illness he had grown immensely fat from lying in bed. Like most Russian refugees, he had had an adventurous life. His parents, killed in the revolution, had been rich people, and he had served through the war in the 2nd Siberian Rifles, which, according to him, was the best regiment in the Russian army. After the war, he had first worked in a brush factory, then as a porter at Les Halles, then had become a dishwasher, and had finally worked his way up to be a waiter. When he fell ill, he was at the Hotel Scrib, and taking 100 francs a day in tips. His ambition was to become a maître d'hôtel, save 50,000 francs, and set up a small, select restaurant on the right bank. Boris always talked of the war as the happiest time of his life. War and soldiering were his passion. He had read innumerable books of strategy and military history, and could tell you all about the theories of Napoleon, Kutuzov, Clausewitz, Moltke, and Foch. Anything to do with soldiers pleased him. His favourite café was the Closerie des Lilas in Montparnasse, simply because the statue of Marshal Ney stands outside it. Later on, Boris and I sometimes went to the Rue de Commerce together. If we went by metro, Boris always got out at Cambronne station instead of Commerce, though Commerce was nearer. He liked the association with General Cambronne, who was called on to surrender at Waterloo and answered simply, "Merde." The only things left to Boris by the revolution were his medals and some photographs of his old regiment. He had kept these when everything else went to the pawn shop. Almost every day he would spread the photographs out on the bed and talk about them. "Voilà, mon ami. There you see me at the head of my company. Fine, big men, eh? Not like these little rats of Frenchmen. A captain at 20, not bad, eh? Yes, a captain in the 2nd Siberian Rifles. And my father was a colonel. Ah, my mon ami, the ups and the downs of life. A captain in the Russian army, and then, piff, the revolution, every penny gone. In 1916, I stayed a week at the Hotel Edouard Sept. In 1920, I was trying for a job as night watchman there. I have been night watchman, cellarman, floor scrubber, dishwasher, porter, lavatory attendant. I have tipped waiters, and I have been tipped by waiters. Ah, but I have known what it is to live like a gentleman, mon ami. I do not say it to boast, but the other day I was trying to compute how many mistresses I have had in my life, and I made it out to be over 200. Yes, at least 200. Ah, well, ça reviendra. Victory is to him who fights the longest. Courage! Etc., etc. Boris had a queer, changeable nature. He always wished himself back in the army, but he had also been a waiter long enough to acquire the waiter's outlook. Though he had never saved more than a few thousand francs, he took it for granted that in the end he would be able to set up his own restaurant and grow rich. All waiters, I afterwards found, talk and think of this. It is what reconciles them to being waiters. Boris used to talk interestingly about hotel life. "Waiting is a gamble," he used to say. "You may die poor, you may make your fortune in a year. You are not paid wages, you depend on tips. 10% of the bill and a commission from the wine companies on champagne corks. Sometimes the tips are enormous. The barman at Maxime's, for instance, makes 500 francs a day. More than 500 in the season. I have made 200 francs a day myself. I was at a hotel in Biarritz in the season. The whole staff, from the manager down to the plongeur, was working 21 hours a day. 21 hours work and 2.5 hours in bed for a month on end. Still, it was worth it, at 200 francs a day. You never know when a stroke of luck is coming. Once, when I was at the Hotel Royal, an American customer sent for me before dinner and ordered 24 brandy cocktails. I brought them all together on a tray in 24 glasses. "Now, garçon," said the customer. He was drunk. "I'll drink 12, and you'll drink 12, and if you can walk to the door afterwards, you get 100 francs. I walked to the door, and he gave me 100 francs. And every night for 6 days he did the same thing, 12 brandy cocktails, then 100 francs. A few months later I heard he had been extradited by the American government. Embezzlement. There is something fine, do you not think, about these Americans?" I liked Boris, and we had interesting times together, playing chess and talking about war and hotels. Boris used often to suggest that I should become a waiter. "The life would suit you," he used to say. "When you are in work with 100 francs a day and a nice mistress, it's not bad. You say you go in for writing. Writing is bosh. There is only one way to make money at writing, and that is to marry a publisher's daughter. But you would make a good waiter if you shaved that moustache off. You are tall, and you speak English. Those are the chief things a waiter needs. Wait till I can bend this accursed leg, mon ami, and then, if you are ever out of a job, come to me." Now that I was short of my rent and getting hungry, I remembered Boris's promise and decided to look him up at once. I did not hope to become a waiter so easily as he had promised, but of course I knew how to scrub dishes, and no doubt he could get me a job in the kitchen. He had said that dishwashing jobs were to be had for the asking during the summer. It was a great relief to remember that I had, after all, one influential friend to fall back on. Chapter 5. A short time before, Boris had given me an address in the Rue du Marché des Blancs Manteaux. All he had said in his letter was that things were not marching too badly, and I assumed that he was back at the Hotel Scribe, touching his 100 francs a day. I was full of hope, and wondered why I had been fool enough not to go to Boris before. I saw myself in a cosy restaurant, with jolly cooks singing love songs as they broke eggs into the pan, and 5 solid meals a day. I even squandered 2.50 francs on a packet of Gaulois Bleu, in anticipation of my wages. In the morning, I walked down to the Rue du Marché des Blancs Manteaux. With a shock, I found it a slummy back street as bad as my own. Boris's hotel was the dirtiest hotel in the street. From its dark doorway there came out a vile, sour odour, a mixture of slops and synthetic soup. It was bouillon zip, 25 centimes a packet. A misgiving came over me. People who drink bouillon zip are starving, or near it. Could Boris possibly be earning 100 francs a day? A surly patron sitting in the office said to me, yes, the Russian was at home, in the attic. I went up 6 flights of narrow, winding stairs, the bouillon zip growing stronger as one got higher. Boris did not answer when I knocked at his door, so I opened it and went in. The room was an attic, 10 feet square, lighted only by a skylight. Its sole furniture, a narrow iron bedstead, a chair, and a washhand stand with one game leg. A long S-shaped chain of bugs marched slowly across the wall above the bed. Boris was lying asleep, naked, his large belly making a mound under the grimy sheet. His chest was spotted with insect bites. As I came in, he woke up, rubbed his eyes, and groaned deeply.
"Name of Jesus Christ!" he exclaimed. "Oh, name of Jesus Christ, my back! Curse it, I believe my back is broken!"
"What's the matter?" I exclaimed.
"My back is broken, that is all. I've spent the night on the floor. Oh, name of Jesus Christ, if you knew what my back feels like!"
"My dear Boris, are you ill?"
"Not ill, only starving. Starving to death if this goes on much longer. Besides sleeping on the floor, I have lived on 2 francs a day for weeks past. It is fearful. You have come at a bad moment, mon ami."
It didn't seem much use to ask whether Boris still had his job at the Hotel Scribe. I hurried downstairs and bought a loaf of bread. Boris threw himself on the bread and ate half of it, after which he felt better, sat up in bed, and told me what was the matter with him. He had failed to get a job after leaving the hospital because he was still very lame, and he had spent all his money and pawned everything, and finally starved for several days. He had slept a week on the quay under the Pont d'Austerlitz, among some empty wine barrels. For the past fortnight he had been living in this room, together with a Jew, a mechanic. It appeared, there was some complicated explanation, that the Jew owed Boris 300 francs and was repaying this by letting him sleep on the floor and allowing him 2 francs a day for food. 2 francs would buy a bowl of coffee and 3 rolls. The Jew went to work at 7 in the mornings, and after that Boris would leave his sleeping place, it was beneath the skylight, which let in the rain, and get into the bed. He couldn't sleep much even there, owing to the bugs, but it rested his back after the floor. It was a great disappointment when I had come to Boris for help, to find him even worse off than myself. I explained that I had only about 60 francs left, and must get a job immediately. By this time, however, Boris had eaten the rest of the bread, and was feeling cheerful and talkative. He said carelessly,
"Good heavens, what are you worrying about? 60 francs? Why, it's a fortune. Please hand me that shoe, mon ami. I'm going to smash some of those bugs if they come within reach."
"But do you think there's any chance of getting a job?"
"Chance? It's a certainty. In fact, I have got something already. There is a new Russian restaurant, which is to open in a few days in the Rue du Commerce. It is the chose entendue that I am to be maître d'hôtel. I can easily get you a job in the kitchen. 500 francs a month and your food. Tips, too, if you're lucky."
"But in the meantime, I've got to pay my rent before long."
"Oh, we shall find something. I have got a few cards up my sleeve. There are people who owe me money, for instance. Paris is full of them. One of them is bound to pay up before long. Then think of all the women who have been my mistress. A woman never forgets, you know. I have only to ask, and they will help me. Besides, the Jew tells me he's going to steal some magnetos from the garage where he works, and he will pay us 5 francs a day to clean them before he sells them. That alone would keep us. Never worry, mon ami. Nothing is easier to get than money."
"Well, let's go out now and look for a job."
"Presently, mon ami. We shan't starve, don't you fear. This is only the fortune of war. I've been in a worse hole scores of times. It's only a question of persisting. Remember Foch's maxim, attaque, attaque, attaque."
It was midday before Boris decided to get up. All the clothes he now had left were one suit with one shirt, collar and tie, a pair of shoes almost worn out, and a pair of socks all holes. He had also an overcoat, which was to be pawned in the last extremity. He had a suitcase, a wretched 20-franc cardboard thing, but very important, because the patron of the hotel believed that it was full of clothes. Without that, he would probably have turned Boris out of doors.
What it actually contained were the medals and photographs, various odds and ends, and huge bundles of love letters. In spite of all this, Boris managed to keep a fairly smart appearance. He shaved without soap and with a razor blade, 2 months old, tied his tie so that the holes didn't show, and carefully stuffed the soles of his shoes with newspaper. Finally, when he was dressed, he produced an ink bottle and inked the skin of his ankles where it showed through his socks. You would never have thought, when it was finished, that he had recently been sleeping under the Seine bridges. We went to a small café off the Rue de Rivoli, a well-known rendezvous of hotel managers and employees. At the back was a dark, cave-like room where all kinds of hotel workers were sitting. Smart young waiters, others not so smart and clearly hungry. Fat pink cooks, greasy dishwashers, battered old scrubbing women. Everyone had an untouched glass of black coffee in front of him. The place was, in effect, an employment bureau, and the money spent on drinks was the patron's commission. Sometimes a stout, important-looking man, obviously a restaurateur, would come in and speak to the barman, and the barman would call to one of the people at the back of the café. But he never called to Boris or me, and we left after 2 hours, as the etiquette was that you could only stay 2 hours for one drink. We learned afterwards, when it was too late, that the dodge was to bribe the barman. If you could afford 20 francs, he would generally get you a job. We went to the Hotel Scream and waited an hour on the pavement, hoping that the manager would come out, but he never did. Then we dragged ourselves down to the Rue du Commerce, only to find that the new restaurant, which was being redecorated, was shut up and the patron away. It was now night. We had walked 14 kilometres over pavement, and we were so tired that we had to waste 1.50 francs on going home by metro. Walking was agony to Boris with his game leg, and his optimism wore thinner and thinner as the day went on. When he got out of the metro at the Place d'Italie, he was in despair. He began to say that it was no use looking for work. There was nothing for it but to try crime. Sooner rob than starve, mon ami. I have often planned it. A fat, rich American. Some dark corner down Montparnasse way. A cobblestone in a stocking. Bang! And then go through his pockets and bolt. It is feasible, do you not think? I would not flinch. I have been a soldier, remember? He decided against the plan in the end, because we were both foreigners and easily recognised. When we had got back to my room, we spent another 1.50 francs on bread and chocolate. Boris devoured his share, and at once cheered up like magic. Food seemed to act on his system as rapidly as a cocktail. He took out a pencil and began making a list of the people who would probably give us jobs. There were dozens of them, he said. Tomorrow we shall find something, mon ami. I know it in my bones. The luck always changes. Besides, we both have brains. A man with brains can't starve. What things a man can do with brains! Brains will make money out of anything. I had a friend once, a Pole, a real man of genius. And what do you think he used to do? He would buy a gold ring and pawn it for 15 francs. Then, you know how carelessly the clerks fill up the tickets. Where the clerk had written on or, he would add a diamond. And he would change 15 francs to 15,000. Neat, huh? Then, you see, he could borrow 1,000 francs on the security of the ticket. That is what I mean by brains. For the rest of the evening, Boris was in a hopeful mood, talking of the times we should have together when we were waiters together at Nice or Biarritz, with smart rooms and enough money to set up mistresses. He was too tired to walk the 3 kilometres back to his hotel, and slept the night on the floor of my room, with his coat rolled round his shoes for a pillow. Chapter 6. We again failed to find work the next day, and it was 3 weeks before the luck changed. My 200 francs saved me from trouble about the rent, but everything else went as badly as possible. Day after day, Boris and I went up and down Paris, drifting at 2 miles an hour through the crowds, bored and hungry and finding nothing. One day, I remember, we crossed the Seine 11 times.
We loitered for hours outside service doorways, and when the manager came out, we would go up to him ingratiatingly, cap in hand. We always got the same answer. They did not want a lame man nor a man without experience. Once we were very nearly engaged. While we spoke to the manager, Boris stood straight upright, not supporting himself with his stick, and the manager did not see that he was lame. "Yes," he said, "we want two men in the cellars. Perhaps you would do. Come inside." Then Boris moved. The game was up. "Ah," said the manager, "you limp." "Malheureusement." We enrolled our names at agencies and answered advertisements, but walking everywhere made us slow, and we seemed to miss every job by half an hour. Once we very nearly got a job swabbing out railway trucks, but at the last moment they rejected us in favour of Frenchmen. Once we answered an advertisement calling for hands at a circus. You had to shift benches and clean up litter, and during the performance stand on two tubs and let a lion jump through your legs. When we got to the place, an hour before the time named, we found a queue of 50 men already waiting. There is some attraction in lions, evidently. Once an agency to which I had applied months earlier sent me a petit bleu, telling me of an Italian gentleman who wanted English lessons. The petit bleu said, "Come at once," and promised 20 francs an hour. Boris and I were in despair. Here was a splendid chance, and I could not take it, for it was impossible to go to the agency with my coat out at the elbow. Then it occurred to us that I could wear Boris's coat. It didn't match my trousers, but the trousers were grey and might pass for flannel at a short distance. The coat was so much too big for me that I had to wear it unbuttoned and keep one hand in my pocket. I hurried out and wasted 75 centimes on a bus fare to get to the agency. When I got there, I found that the Italian had changed his mind and left Paris. Once, Boris suggested that I should go to Les Halles and try for a job as a porter. I arrived at 4:30 in the morning, when the work was getting into its swing. Seeing a short, fat man in a bowler hat directing some porters, I went up to him and asked for work.